From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Today, state lawmakers in Missouri are expected to pass a law banning abortions at 8 weeks of pregnancy, and Republican Governor Mike Parson is expected to sign it. Missouri would join Alabama and several other states that have moved to restrict abortion rights in an effort to overturn the 1973 Supreme Court decision Roe v. Wade, which legalized abortion.
Our Friday Politics Roundtable joins us to talk about that and more. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Great to be with you.
And Tolu Olorunipa, White House reporter for The Washington Post, is with us as well. Hi, Tolu.
Hi, happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. And let's start with the abortion politics this week. Earlier this week, Alabama's governor signed a law banning nearly all abortions, with no exception for rape or incest. Several prominent Republicans, including televangelist Pat Robertson and House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, said it goes too far. Rick, what's the politics here for the GOP?
It's fascinating that Republicans who have long advocated to see Roe v. Wade overturned, to see abortion limited, are almost silent and actually quite concerned that this law goes too far. And I think the concern is twofold. One is whether it's successful in overturning Roe v. Wade, this might not be the best case to do it, because it is a pretty extreme position to not have any exceptions really ruled out, carved out of the law. And second, I think it recognizes that this is still precarious politics. This is not an easy issue for Republicans, despite the rallying cry they've used abortion, anti-abortion around for so long. They recognize that this could easily become a motivating issue for Democrats if, in fact, the women's right to choose is being threatened.
Tolu, does that mean this instantly became a major 2020 campaign issue?
It has, definitely, on the Democratic side. You've seen almost every Democratic presidential candidate put out a statement or call for new fundraising based on this issue, calling for people to donate to pro-choice groups across the country. But it's interesting that you have not heard much from the Trump campaign or President Trump himself. He likes to weigh in on almost every issue of the day, but he hasn't said anything publicly about this abortion issue. He hasn't tweeted about it. I actually asked his campaign about it earlier this week, and they deferred to the White House and did not decide to weigh in specifically on these bills that are being passed in places like Alabama and Georgia. So it is definitely inflaming some of the tensions on one side of the aisle, but it seems like the other side, the Republican side, has gone silent.
Rick, could you just go through what each of the 24 Democrats think about this?
No, yes.
Just kidding.
How long's your show?
Just kidding. Let's talk about some of the other news this week. There are new developments in the Russia investigation. Last night, a judge ordered the public release of a 2017 voicemail between former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and President Trump's personal lawyer, who wanted to get a heads up if Flynn had any damaging information about the president. Rick, is that big news?
I think it is interesting context and texture for what the report found about potential for obstruction of justice to have occurred. Of course, there was an inconclusive judgment, but it does suggest that there may have been efforts here to try to influence testimony. And I think it underscores the importance from Democrats' perspective of seeing the underlying evidence, of talking to key witnesses, including Bob Mueller himself.
Tolu, Robert Mueller knew about this voicemail, didn't he? I mean, did the report have anything to say about it?
Yeah, the Mueller report did include some excerpts from this call, this voicemail that was left by President Trump's personal lawyer. It'll be very interesting if we actually get to hear the call. But basically what Robert Mueller reported was that Trump's personal lawyer was telling Michael Flynn that he should give them a heads up if he's going to say anything that implicates the president. He even said it's a national security issue, that if you're going to implicate the president, you should let our legal team know. And he also talked about how President Trump had a fond feeling for Michael Flynn, sort of talking in positive terms about how, you know, before you decide to cooperate with investigators, remember that the president likes you and that he's a fan of yours. And then after Michael Flynn decided to cooperate, the tone changed very significantly, and President Trump's personal lawyer became very angry and, as Mueller put it, indignant towards Michael Flynn that he was cooperating with federal investigators.
Rick, what are the chances we're going to hear from Robert Mueller on Capitol Hill, as Democrats would like?
I think it's almost certain. And there's still things that still have to happen, and I wonder what the holdup has been. But the attorney general said he's open to it. The president has said he would defer to the attorney general. We don't know about Mueller himself. We know that the teams are talking. But yes, I do believe we're going to hear from Robert Mueller at some point.
And then there are also all these investigations going on into the president by the House Democrats. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on her strategy to investigate the president.
First we ask, then we subpoena friendly. Then we subpoena otherwise, and then we see what we get.
Tolu, where do the Democrats stand right now in all these investigations, which the White House has been stonewalling, and the idea of impeachment, which the Democrats really, it sounds like, don't want to go there because they think it'll actually help the president?
Yeah, Nancy Pelosi did not say what happens after you subpoena not so friendly and you don't get what you want. A number of Democrats do believe that impeachment is at the end of that road, and some of them are pretty fed up already. They believe they've waited long enough, they've been patient enough with the president and with his administration as they've stonewalled and as they've rejected these various document requests. And some are ready to go fully towards impeachment. Others are calling for lawsuits and fines for Trump administration officials. But it's clear that the Democrats in Congress are fed up with the fact that the president's administration does not believe that it has to respond to their requests, and they're looking for different ways to try to put pressure on the Trump administration. It's sort of a maximum pressure campaign, if you will, where they're trying to make sure that the Trump administration and President Trump's allies all feel pressure to cooperate with their investigations, and if not, impeachment may be at the end of the road.
Rick, the president said this week that he hopes the United States is not going to war with Iran. There have been a lot of stories this week as well about the hardliners inside the White House, Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, who are getting ahead of the president on this issue. What Iran policy do you think the president actually wants?
Oh, he wants to undo the nuclear deal, and he's already made that clear. And I think a lot of this is not just the pressure from inside his administration. It's also from Israel, which has advocated for a long time with the Netanyahu government, a very strong hard line against Iran. I tend to think he is speaking honestly when he says he hopes there isn't a war. Of course, he has something to say or do with that. I think this is going to be a critical couple of days, though, because we haven't seen the intelligence that these machinations are based on. And it has a lot of echoes of Iraq 2003 for people that are looking from the outside. What do they have? What is the urgency here, and what are the consequences of the information that we're gathering?
That's even frustrating his allies on Capitol Hill in Congress, who say, let us see some of this intelligence. We're in the dark here.
Well, and in fact, we spoke with the House chairman of the Armed Services Committee yesterday, who said he has been briefed by the Pentagon, and he doesn't see any increase in the threat over what's existed from Iran for many years. Rick.
Yeah, and I think that's a concern that so many of his friends and allies and even political enemies have. Is what are we doing here exactly? And you're not seeing other countries react accordingly with this sort of intelligence. So what are they seeing? I think there's going to be efforts to declassify some things in the coming days, and I think that's going to be critical for the outcome.
Let's take a couple of minutes just to talk about 2020. We won't go through every single one of the candidates, but the newest one is New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, who entered the race for president this week, criticizing President Trump and supporting the Green New Deal from progressives, the climate change agenda. And on ABC's The View, host Whoopi Goldberg scoffed.
Not a good career move, man. Here's the thing that you didn't mention. Homelessness is near record highs. Congestion pricing will take the minimum wage money that we just gave to people. It'll take it away from them.
So some of the New York City politics there. Tolu, de Blasio, your thoughts?
Yeah, and then there were 23 candidates on the Democratic side running for president. De Blasio, the latest to jump in. A number of New Yorkers are not happy that he's getting in, citing some of the problems that he continues to face in the city of New York. But he is saying, you know, I am an executive in one of the biggest cities in the world, and I have a record of pushing forward progressive policies, anything from free pre-K to $15 minimum wage to making sure people have health care, and he wants to take that national. So he does have a record to run on, and Donald Trump won in 2016, and I think a number of Democrats think if Trump could do it, why not me?
But Rick, why do you think there are candidates that are still getting into this race? Do they seriously think that they have a chance of differentiating themselves and winning at this point? It seems sort of ridiculous.
I don't know how you look yourself in the mirror and say there aren't enough candidates. I do think there's a number of these candidates that, like de Blasio, or term limited or otherwise blocked politically, that say, hey, why not me? And maybe you get yourself some name recognition. Maybe you catch fire. I've heard a number of candidates talk about the Mayor Pete phenomena as a reason to stay in or to get in. Hey, who knew that Pete Buttigieg would be a big deal 2 months ago? And of course, he's now, I think, considered a top-tier contender.
Well, and let's listen to one more clip from one of the candidates this week, Kamala Harris, saying Joe Biden would make a good vice presidential pick. Here she is.
Sure, if people want to speculate about running mates, I encourage that, because I think that Joe Biden would be a great running mate. As vice president, he's proven that he knows how to do the job.
Tolu, as you listen to that, I mean, all these candidates are now having to measure up against Joe Biden, who's clearly the front runner at this moment.
Yeah, they are battling the idea that Joe Biden is presenting himself as the presumptive nominee to go against Donald Trump at this point. And it's a delicate balance because they don't want to attack Joe Biden, who was served as the vice president to a popular Democratic president and President Obama for 8 years. So they were trying to figure out how to take on Joe Biden. You've seen some like Bernie Sanders go very directly against his record. Some have been a little bit more delicate and pushing back against him, like we saw from Senator Harris there. But Biden right now is at the top of the pack with all the polling, and it's clear that the rest of the field is trying to catch up.
Rick, I don't have time to ask you about Beto O'Rourke's live-streamed haircut talking about ear hair. That's where this has gone. Rick Klein, political director at ABC News, and Tolu Olorunipah, White House reporter at The Washington Post. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
How much of your trash do you recycle? Well, if you are like the average American, about 26% of what you throw away ends up in the blue recycling bin. If you live in Indianapolis, it is a very different story, because Indianapolis is one of the most wasteful cities in America. Just 4% of its trash is recycled each year. And according to the Indianapolis Star, it's the biggest city in the country without a universal curbside recycling program. As part of our series, Going to Waste, we're going to try to find out what's holding them back. And let's start with Katie Robinson. She's director of the Office of Sustainability for the City of Indianapolis. Katie, welcome.
Thank you so much, Peter. It's a pleasure.
And what about that statistic, 4% recycling rate in Indianapolis? Do you see it as a black eye for the city?
Not necessarily. I actually see it as an opportunity for us to grow a program that fits, given the climate that we're experiencing right now in the United States.
The way it works in your city now is people either have to go somewhere to drop off recycling, or they could pay a subscription fee to have someone come and pick it up off their curb. But why doesn't Indianapolis have a blue bin on the curb of every house?
No, that's a fair question. And we have about 267,000 households in Marion County who are geographically huge, 403 square miles. And so for the past 30 years, we've been operating with a fee that has stayed flat for the last 30 years. It's $32 a year for our citizens to throw their stuff away. And if you are a subscriber to our recycling program, it's about $8 a month. And we have about 10%, so about 26,600 households that actually do participate in that curbside recycling program.
But apparently that's a disincentive because your recycling rate is very low.
So in fairness, we add a layer, right? So if you want to subscribe, they have to contact Republic, who is our subscription provider. So it just adds a layer that people have to make that effort to call someone to add in that additional service in order to recycle.
Well, what do you think the environmental impacts of that low recycling rate have been?
So we have seen, we actually just completed the city's greenhouse gas inventory, and our emissions from waste is continuing to grow rather rapidly. In fact, it was kind of striking to see that increase. And so we are very concerned, and it's one of the incentives that the city sort of sees is bringing in a curbside recycling program, is we need to get some of that waste processed accordingly.
And those emissions, are they from methane coming from a landfill, or is it from particulates coming out of your incinerator?
So that's a fair question. I would say that that's primarily going to be from our landfill. So we also have to address the food waste, too. So in addition to our commitment to adding curbside recycling by 2025, our hope is to also add, and I know this sounds a little bit redundant, but add at least a subscription. So at minimum, offer a subscription composting service to our entire program.
So universal curbside recycling in Indianapolis by 2025, that's still 6 years away. Why is it taking so long to do something like that? I'm sure people are going crazy that they can't recycle that peanut butter jar that they just toss in the trash.
Peter, if you recycle your peanut butter jar, more power to you. I can never get it completely clean.
Fair enough.
No, so it, yes, we all want to flip that switch tomorrow, but we need to be really strategic about how we introduce recycling in a very successful way. We could flip the switch tomorrow, have a recycling program. We may fail at it. We need to make sure that given the issues that we're dealing with China, we are trying to look at the full holistic implementation of such a program.
Okay, we're going to talk about China in just a minute, but let's bring in Allison Mitchell. She is the executive director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition. And Allison, first of all, is it like this across the entire state of Indiana, or is this something unique to the city?
So this is kind of unique to the city of Indianapolis. There are other communities in the state of Indiana that have a more robust and a more successful recycling program. I think that the legacy that we have with the incinerator here in Indianapolis has acted as a disincentive for Indianapolis to implement universal curbside recycling and therefore have a robust program, you know, on par with national standards in terms of the rate.
So you're referring to the complaints over the years that have been that Indianapolis has this contract with a company that burns the garbage from the city and that the contract requires the city to essentially supply a certain amount of trash every year. And so you got to feed the beast, so to speak. Is that what you're referring to?
Yes. And those restrictions on the contract minimums for the amount of waste to be sent to the incinerator are no longer in place. But yes, that contract is in existence until 2025, and that's why 2025 is kind of the magic date in terms of making this, you know, significant shift in the way that this community views and values its waste to get it out of the trash and put more into the recycling bin, at least the proper recyclables.
Well, what about that? Does this make people angry?
We take phone calls and we get confusion, perplexion, and we do hear some anger from people that, especially when they move from other parts of the country and they come to Indianapolis, they expect to see the same level of services that they had in other cities of our size. And when they come here and realize that they have to pay extra and take an extra effort to recycle, they're frustrated.
And I think also, too, with that, recycling does tend to look different in every single city. And so I think that's also the level of frustration that people are experiencing, is that what you may be able to recycle here might look different in Los Angeles or San Francisco. And so I think that's also a level of frustration that we hear.
Okay. Katie Robinson, speaking of that, I was in Baltimore last month speaking with the director of public works, Rudy Chow. Like many U.S. cities, he's dealing with the fact that China has recently decided to stop taking U.S. recyclables. Let's listen to a little bit of our conversation.
The whole recycling market is in somewhat of a chaos right now. It's because the China situation, where we used to actually get paid to recycle, we're now actually paying someone else to haul away our recyclables. And so that economic equation has changed.
Baltimore is now paying hundreds of thousands of dollars extra every year to recycle. As you know, some cities are just shutting down their programs in response to this policy shift. How do you start a brand new program under these conditions?
I see this as an opportunity, right? Like, timing actually works in our favor in this instance where we don't have a universal program in place. And so given the challenges that are existing throughout this country, we can now layer in those factors and make sure, again, that we're heavy on education on the front end so that we're trying to lower those contamination rates once we start this program. But then also, we are so incredibly fortunate in Indiana to actually have processors located within the state.
Recyclers.
Yes. We do. We have the end markets that most other states don't have, and they were much more reliant upon China to take the physical materials. State of Indiana never did and still does not ship its materials to China. We have a manufacturing base in the state of Indiana, and we have the processors that are the step in between your blue bin and those manufacturing facilities.
So you're saying the rates that other cities have seen go up would not affect the city of Indianapolis?
Well, the part of the China ban that all of us are influenced by and we cannot escape is the value of the materials, because there's such an oversupply of those materials in the United States and other countries as well. As a result of the China ban, those depressed market values for those commodities are something we all have to deal with. But we have the proximity of the end markets and the processors here within the state of Indiana, and they are actually really hungry for our materials. And that's why a recycling program in the city of Indianapolis is really well positioned to be successful, because we can supply those manufacturers, and we can get fantastic rates because we are the crossroads of America. We've got logistics down in the state of Indiana.
Katie Robinson, as the director of the city's Office of Sustainability, do you think you can change the culture of a city that's resisted recycling for so long?
So that's our number one priority. I think our hope, Allison and I both feel this way, that our hope is that we can also influence people to consider the amount of consumption and just start looking at how they are what they're consuming and try to reduce that as well.
How do you manage to recycle? Do you?
I do recycle. Good. It would look really bad, Peter, if the director of sustainability didn't recycle.
That's why I asked.
Yes, absolutely. I recycle.
On a subscription service?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do try to separate my paper so that it doesn't get contaminated.
All right. That's Katie Robinson. She's Director of Sustainability for the City of Indianapolis, and Allison Mitchell, Executive Director of the Indiana Recycling Coalition. Thanks for speaking with me. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
Your time and your interest.
And by the way, according to the Indianapolis Star, nearby Chicago isn't doing much better. That city has a 10% recycling rate. Memphis and Louisville are at 40%. And on the West Coast, San Francisco is king thanks to a robust recycling and composting program. The city's landfill diversion rate is a whopping 80%. Of course, all these numbers may change now that China has upended the industry with its decision to stop taking U.S. recyclables. If you have an interesting story about waste where you live, let us know at hereandnow.org. And this note from Gatlinburg, Tennessee, where the longest pedestrian suspension bridge in North America is opening today. The Gatlinburg Sky Bridge stretches 680 feet across a valley in the Great Smoky Mountains. Developers of the bridge say people can walk at their own pace and gawk at the sweeping views. There's also a glass floor in part of the bridge, so you can look straight down 140 feet to the valley below, and if you're like me, get a little weak-kneed in the process. If you're wondering where the longest pedestrian suspension bridge in the world is, it's in Switzerland, and it's about 1,000 feet longer than the new bridge in Tennessee.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that is designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Ember Wave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, cold restaurants, after a workout, at home, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. Learn more at emberwave.com. Emberwave, balance through temperature.
Architecture has lost one of its giants. I Am Pei, who was born in China and added elegance to the landscape from west to east, died in Manhattan yesterday at the age of 102. He was perhaps best known for designing the East Building of the National Gallery of Art in Washington and the Glass Pyramid at the entrance to the Louvre in Paris. But he did so much more. And joining us now to talk about him is Pulitzer Prize-winning Chicago Tribune architecture critic Blair Kamen. Blair, first of all, what is the significance of this loss in the world of architecture?
Well, it's a big loss. I Am Pei had a tremendous life. He lived to the ripe old age of 102. And he brought modernism to innumerable facets of American life, from airport control towers to housing to our great cultural buildings and civic buildings. So he really made modernism, I think, acceptable to a mass audience. And yet he designed according to the highest standards of beautiful materials, elegant proportions. So he really was able to straddle the worlds of form, function, business, and art in a way that very few architects were.
Now, we can't list all of the work that he did, but remind us of some of the other buildings that he designed.
Well, I mean, certainly the most notable of pay is the Louvre Pyramid. Mm-hmm. This was an enormously controversial project. I mean, a non-Frenchman coming into Paris and proposing this 71-foot-high pyramid in this symbol of French culture, it created a firestorm of criticism. And yet, it was a very logical plan, created a new entrance for the Louvre, underground galleries that allowed this age-old French monument to really revive. And it really, you know, became a symbol that was beloved of Paris and just a great testament not only to Pei's design skills but also his perseverance. I mean, I met him. He was an elegant, gentlemanly, charming person, and yet he also had a real forcefulness to him. You had to have that if you were going to storm into Paris and change a great symbol of French culture.
Did he have his critics?
Well, he did. I mean, certainly not all of his buildings were considered triumphs. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland was considered a bit of an assemblage or a kind of melange of some of his previous projects, like the Louvre. But on the whole, I think he was greatly admired. I mean, he won the Pritzker Architecture Prize, mm-hmm. the field's highest honor, and won just about every conceivable honor you can get.
Well, when I walk my dog now in Boston, I can look out and see the JFK Library, which is one of his buildings. What's your favorite?
I love the National Gallery of Art East Wing in Washington, D.C. It's a building that fits a very complex trapezoidal site. It has a kind of drama to it that I think is notable of Pei's work. And anyone who's been in the grand lobby of that building with its skylights and Calder sculpture realizes that people are as much a part of the architecture as the building itself. And this is one of the things I think that really draws us to Pei's work. He isn't just designing abstractions. People become an enlivening and animating part of the work.
That is Blair Kamen, who's architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune, talking with us about I.M. Pei, who died yesterday at the age of 102. Blair Kamen, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's a sad occasion, but a life very much worth celebrating.
Portugal was one of the five countries that received multi-billion dollar bailouts during the Eurozone debt crisis. Well, 8 years later, the country's economy has recovered. Its budget deficit is now near zero, the lowest level in more than 40 years. And figures released this week show gross domestic product, or GDP, up about 2% in the first quarter of 2019. Joining us now is Pedro Brinca, who's professor of economics at the Nova School of Business and Economics. He's with us from Lisbon, Portugal. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
So based on these numbers, it sounds like Portugal is a success story in terms of the bailouts. Do you see it that way?
Well, it is. I mean, Portugal has, since the democracy started in our country in the mid-70s, has never had a budget surplus in the history of the country since then. And the budget deficit, as you said, well said at the introduction, has been at its lowest level since then. And it's projected to become a surplus around 2020 or 2021, which would be really historical because it has never happened. What I think it was crucial also for this is that, you know, when you have big crisis, that's when it comes the political opportunity to promote big structural changes. And Portugal had a decade of very slow growth, which made it very hard to do structural changes that the country needed in order to remain competitive in the international scene. Mm-hmm. And the crisis was actually a very good opportunity to do so. So we balanced our external accounts. We became very close to turn a surplus in our external accounts. We deleveraged a lot in terms of private debt, which also promotes investment and so forth. So all of these things were very unlikely to happen if it wasn't some outside external force kind of, you know, mm-hmm. Obliging the parties to come together to, you know, an understanding and enforcing all these changes.
But you didn't go the austerity route the way that the Greeks did, right?
It's orders of magnitude different, okay? So Greece can only be compared to the USA in the 1929. Great Depression. Mm-hmm. That's the order of magnitude we're talking about. In Portugal, things were bad, but not epically bad as in Greece. We had austerity. We reduced our public spending in about 11%, I think. So yeah, we had austerity, both in terms of reduction of public expenditure, but also in terms of tax increases. So one of the issues, even though we've had this story of successful consolidation of the public finances, one of the issues is that we still have one of the highest debt of GDP ratios in the Eurozone. And, you know, if there's some crisis or something, we don't really have much fiscal space mm-hmm. in order to spend our way out of the crisis.
And what about in the issue of jobs? How has unemployment been? I know that in 2013, it was 18%, even higher for young people. A lot of them left the country to find work. But today, it's around 7%.
Yeah. So indeed, we during the crisis, we had a huge, massive outflow of people, like to the tune of 450,000, which, of course, for the U.S. doesn't mean much, but for Portugal is 5% of population. And exactly as you were saying, this hit more the young people, and these were the ones who were leaving.
And where did they go, by the way?
Well, a lot of them go to England, they go to France, they go to some to the U.S., I guess, but most of them to Europe. Okay, mm-hmm. most of them to Europe. Now, the thing about the unemployment rate, it is a success, but one needs to be careful because 18% is huge for U.S. standards. You know, for Spain, is a Tuesday. So that's right. One thing. Second thing, but still, it was high, and it came down a lot, both because, you know, these people left the country, so they don't count for the statistics of unemployment. And second, also because long-term people that were unemployed for a long time, they become discouraged and they ended up also not counting for the statistics. So one also has to have that into account. But of course, I mean, even factoring all these things into the accounting, it's still a success that we managed to get unemployment so low.
Now, one thing that a lot of Americans know in 2019 is that Portugal has become a real tourist destination in a way that it probably wasn't 10 years ago. How much has that helped the economy there?
I think, it helped a lot. And actually, it's one of the issues. I mean, it's good that we had it, but if you look at the productivity numbers, they didn't grow much. And one of the reasons is that because, you know, a good part of our growth came from tourism, which typically is not a sector that tends to show much dynamism in terms of productivity growth. Now, we're very lucky with the Arab Spring and, you know, with all the instability in some of these countries that diverted a lot of tourism to Portugal. And also, I guess, Portugal being in a crisis and in the news actually, you know, help people noticing and knowing that we existed. Mm-hmm. But of course, I mean, a big, big challenge is for us to be able to continue growing in spite of whatever may happen to the tourism sector, because eventually, you know, Egypt and Tunisia and all these destinations that people stopped going to come to Portugal, they might stabilize soon, and then, of course, we'll have a harder time. Another thing that we should not underestimate is actually Brexit, because if you go to Algarve in the summer, the highest nationality group in Algarve are precisely English people. The second highest, Portuguese. So that's just how many people from Britain go to Algarve. And with Brexit, and if the pound devaluates, I mean, we might lose a lot of that tourism.
A lot of that tourism.
Yeah.
Have you had the same political issues in Portugal that some other countries in Europe have had, a rise of the political right, a rise in anti-immigrant sentiment, and even a rise in anti-European sentiment that people want to leave the European Union?
So the answer is a blunt no. So Portugal, unlike many other countries in Europe that you so correctly referred, we don't have a single right-wing or far right-wing, if you want, a seat in the parliament. Not one MP is in the parliament from one of those fringe parties. Traditionally, Portugal has always been, there's always racial problems and tensions everywhere with racism and xenophobic feelings. But Portugal, I tend to believe or feel that it's on the better side of things on that respect. Parties tend to be moderate, I would say. We don't have any of those extremisms.
And not a lot of people wanting to leave the European Union.
Relative to the European Union, I would say that there's a little bit more skepticism, but still far away from anything that would jeopardize our position as a pro-EU country. I think of all the parties with parliamentary representation, I think only the Communist Party, with maybe 10% or 8% of the MPs, is actually in favor of leaving the euro. So.
Now, the government in Portugal is a socialist government. It's led by Prime Minister António Costa, who faces an election later this year. Have the cutbacks in public spending affected the social safety net in Portugal, or how strong is it?
Yeah, so in terms of the public infrastructure, for sure, because we've had one of the lowest public investment successive budgets in the history of the country. Now, it is true that this was after many decades where we had big, big investments in our infrastructure. So our road infrastructures are amazing. We benefited from the second wave of digitalization of the financial system. So our ATM machines are brand new, all these things. But in terms of public investment in some infrastructures, like hospitals and schools, you can start showing that, you know, they're under a little bit stress, our health system is underfunded, and so forth. In terms of social safety nets, as you directly posed, we didn't change much in terms of the social benefits regarding to the unemployment benefits and stuff like that. So that safety net kind of remained constant. But of course, one has to consider that in Southern Europe, informal networks are also very, very important. So family, friends, and so forth, they end up also being a strong safety net. And of course, just looking at numbers might underestimate the social insurance that people actually enjoy. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think from the social safety net side, people got hurt on their wages, but in terms of social insurance, you know, health system is still majorly free with universal healthcare. We have public education is also free. It's more on the income and the wages and then unemployment that the crisis hit, and not so much in terms of, you know, social insurance.
That's Pedro Brinca, who is a professor of economics at the Nova School of Business and Economics in Lisbon, Portugal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Next guest is alone in the Bronx. Noelle Santos opened the Lit Bar last month, making her the owner of the only general interest bookstore in the New York City borough. Just next door, Manhattan has nearly 100. I spoke with Santos recently and asked her how business was going.
It was a wild grand opening. We had an opening event series from Thursday through Tuesday. So today we are putting back the store back together and restocking.
Are people buying books?
Absolutely. We almost sold out by Sunday. By the Sunday event, we were panicked.
Well, now, what do you mean? Like the shelves are empty?
We had they were up until this morning. Wow. So we had about 2 to 3 books left on each shelf. And so we're talking about thousands of titles gone.
Okay, help me understand something. How is it possible that you operate the only general interest bookstore in a borough of 1.5 million people?
I don't know. And I got tired of asking that question and coming up empty. So I decided to do something about it.
But it was not always the plan, right? I mean, you haven't been an entrepreneur. You weren't planning to go into books as a living, right?
No, I was living my best life. I'm doing exactly what I studied in school,
which was
human resources and accounting. I worked for an IT firm. I was, climbing the corporate ladder. That was the life goal. And it wasn't until I signed a petition in October 2014 to save our Barnes & Noble, which was the only bookstore at that time, that stopped me in my tracks. And I lit my life on fire to make this happen.
So you take your sick days in your job as a human resources officer and your vacation days, and you fly to Florida to take a class called Owning a Bookstore. And then what happened?
I went to that course. I didn't get all the answers, but I left with all the questions that I was going to need to embark on this journey. And that was getting started on my business plan and looking into real estate. So I came home. I entered City Foundation's New York Startup Business Plan Competition, and I beat out 358 other New York City startups and wow. won the prize money, took my prize money, and I bought pop-up shop supplies. And I tested the market in different areas of the Bronx through the pop-up shops to see, like, where would be the best place to put it, huh. where it would be accessible, you know, where there was enough income and interest to sustain the store.
So speaking of a business plan, you are now running a bookstore in the era of Amazon. How do you deal with that?
I don't really think about them. I feel like we're completely different business models. I don't compete on price, and that's it. That's pretty much all they have on me. The Lit Bar and other and independent bookstores in general, our strength is that we represent the communities that we operate in. Our inventory, our events, our programming, our hiring. Everything about independent bookstores is superior to what you will find on Amazon. Amazon is not a bookstore. They're an algorithm. And that's all they have on us is price.
How much business do you have to do in a month to keep above water?
Well, I'm in New York City, so
a lot.
Everything is more so a lot. But and I'm also a wine bar. That kind of changes a lot. Yeah.
I know you have been posting about Nipsey Hussle. This is the rapper who was murdered recently outside of his clothing mm-hmm. store in South Central Los Angeles. I wonder if you see some sort of similarities between what he was doing and what he was striving to do in some underappreciated neighborhoods and what you're trying to do there in the Bronx.
Absolutely. My community, me personally, were deeply affected by that loss. I wasn't really familiar with his music, but whenever he talked, I listened because he talked about, you know, buying the block, which is essentially communities empowering themselves, buying real estate and making sure that we have a seat at the table, making sure that we're educating ourselves because our education systems are in inner cities are not funded, you know, just like our neighbors right next door in Manhattan or Brooklyn. When he passed, I got a lot of responses saying, Noel, you're our Nipsey. We need you to be careful. You know, some people in the community look at me that way. Someone who was from this neighborhood looking to, you know, to bring the resources here. And as I learn things, I give it away for free.
And now you own a bookstore. So I'm going to ask you my final question here. What are you reading? What can you recommend for us?
That's tough because as a bookseller, I read like 6 to 9 months ahead of the country. So I'm always very lonely in my reading.
Oh, you can't tell us why it hasn't come out yet. Aren't you lucky?
Yeah, I'm reading Dominicana by Angie Cruz, but it doesn't come out till September 9th. But Elizabeth Acevedo's With the Fire on High just dropped, and I'm super pumped about that.
Noel Santos is owner of The Lit Bar in Mott Haven in the Bronx. It's the Bronx's only general interest bookstore open today. Noel, I'm going to let you get back to work, but thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Jeremy, we've got a program note here. You're going to be in Louisville, Kentucky.
Will be there next Tuesday. We'll be broadcasting from WFPL in Louisville. It is going to be primary election day in Kentucky. We're going to be talking to voters also in Kentucky about the senior senator, that would be Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, and how they feel about him there in his home state. So tune in for that on Tuesday.
Have a bourbon for me.
We will definitely do that.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dell.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.